afternoon to one and all. You're listening to The Global Voice, and it's time once again for What's Cooking with me, Sue Hatfield. I hope I find you all well, and as usual, we've got rather a packed programme, so let's get this show on the road. If you've been listening to this programme for the past couple of months, you'll know that we've been concentrating on a baking theme. We had a programme about bread last month, and the month before we talked about pastry. We're going to bring the baking theme to a close this month, and we're going to talk about cake. Yes, cake. A food I think we either love or hate, and yes, I really do believe that. I'm not a great lover of cake at all, really. I definitely have to be in the mood for cake, but when there's cake around and I say, no, I don't want any, or no, thank you, people seem to think, what, you don't want cake? Goodness me, everybody likes cake, but I'm sorry, I don't think they do. Yes, it is very popular, and lots of people do like it, but I'm certainly not that much in favour and have to be in the mood for it. Cakes come in different shapes and sizes, shop-bought, homemade. Many, many recipes for cakes, books and books and books filled with all manner of recipes for fancy cakes, plain cakes, etc. But how did this cake making all start? Well, Roman and Greek history records cake making, but according to food historians, it's the Egyptians who were the first skilled bakers. We've come a long way from there. What the Egyptians and even medieval Europeans called cake wouldn't be recognisable to us as such today. Although the Egyptians wouldn't even have called it cake, that's a word that has been used in Britain since the 13th century and is a derivation of the Old Norse word kaka. The first cakes bore a strong similarity to bread. The Romans sometimes added egg or butter and sweetened the dough with honey, sometimes including nuts or dried fruit. The richer you were, it seems, the more often you could eat cake, and they frequently formed part of banquets. In 14th century Britain, Chaucer writes of immense cakes made for special occasions. He records one that was made with 13 kilograms of flour and contained butter, cream, eggs, spices, currants, and honey. A prime feature of a cake was its shape, round and flat. Shaped by hand into a ball, the dough naturally relaxed out to a circular shape. By the 17th century, cake hoops were being used to cook the cake. Made of wood or tin, these ensured the cake kept a neat round shape. Around the world, cakes have played a central role in people's worship and rituals, with the circular shape symbolising the cyclical nature of the seasons and life. The Chinese offered up round cakes at harvest time to honour their moon goddess, Heng O. Russians traditionally made blini, thin round cakes, to pay their respects to a god, and the ancient Celts, on the first day of spring, rolled cakes down a hill, hoping to persuade the sun to keep on rotating. Even today, at any special event, there is likely to be a cake of some sort involved in the celebration. But now, let's get back to how the flat, bread-like cake evolved into today's Victoria sponge. While yeast was the prime raising agent at first, it was in the middle of the 19th century that a discovery was made that changed how cakes were made, how they looked, and how they tasted. Alfred Bird, a British chemist, introduced an improved type of baking powder. A mixture of bicarbonate of soda and an acid as a raising agent in the place of yeast. This allowed for greater leavening with less effort, and this, combined with an improvement in temperature, accuracy and constancy in ovens, meant that cake baking really took off, even if it was in slightly different directions depending on country. In Britain, cakes have a wholesomeness about them. They're satisfying. Simple ingredients are taken and combined to make something yummy, and usually quite substantial. On the other hand, the French word gâteau suggests a much lighter cake, often filled with cream, or more likely, crème pâtisserie, and fruit, very beautifully decorated and presented. Other European cakes tend to be along similar lines, or richer, like Sachertorte, or more pastry-based. While homemade is a prized label in Britain, our European counterparts are more likely to sing the praises of the local patisserie. Further into Eastern Europe, the cakes are darker, spicier, and fruitier, while the Far East has very little tradition of cake baking. America took cake baking to its heart and has a fine tradition that blends homemade, like brownies, with fancy, like frosted devil's food cake. The ability to make the lightest of sponges or the most delicious fruit cake was one of the prized virtues of a housewife for the first half of the 20th century. Then the 60s brought women's lib, ushering in a different era where women left the home to go out to work, leaving little time or inclination for home baking. But things, as we said earlier, tend to be cyclical. Eating healthily and knowing what's in what we're eating is valued more than ever today. And as anyone who has ever come home to a warm kitchen and the smell of a cake baking will tell you, nothing beats a homemade cake. So let's start with something very simple. In our potted history there, you heard me mention the Victoria sponge. This is a very easy cake to make and was certainly the first cake I ever made at school, I think. I'm going to make it a little bit more interesting today and actually make a Victoria sandwich. The traditional Victoria sandwich is a baking classic and a tasty tea time treat. For this recipe, you will need 4 free range eggs, 225 grams, 8 ounces caster sugar, plus a little extra for dusting the finished cake. 225 grams, 8 ounces self-raising flour, 2 teaspoons baking powder, 220 grams, 8 ounces baking spread, margarine or soft butter at room temperature, plus a little to grease the tins. To serve, good quality strawberry or raspberry jam. You could use any jam really. I find apricot is quite nice, or plum, but you can use any jam you like. Whipped double cream, which is, of course, optional. And
this is what you do.
1. Preheat the oven to 180 degrees C, 350 degrees F, gas 4. 2. Grease and line 2 20 cm, that's 8 inch, sandwich tins. Use a piece of baking or silicone paper. Rub a little baking spread or butter around the inside of the tins until the sides and base are lightly coated. Line the bottom of the tins with a circle of baking or silicone paper. 3. Break the eggs into a large mixing bowl, then add the sugar, flour, baking powder, and baking spread. 4. Mix everything together until well combined. The easiest way to do this is with an electric hand mixer, but you can use a wooden spoon. Put a damp cloth under the bowl when you're mixing to stop it moving around. Be careful not to overmix. As soon as everything is blended, you should stop. The finished mixture should be of a soft dropping consistency, which means it should fall off a spoon easily. 5. Divide the mixture evenly between the tins. This doesn't need to be exact, but you can weigh the filled tins if you want to check. Use a spatula to remove all of the mixture from the bowl and gently smooth the surface of the cakes. 6. Place the tins on the middle shelf of the oven and bake for 25 minutes. 7. The cakes are done when they're golden brown and coming away from the edge of the tins. Press them gently to check. They should be springy to the touch. Remove them from the oven and set aside to cool in their tins for 5 minutes. Then run a pallet or rounded butter knife around the inside edge of the tin and carefully turn the cakes out onto a cooling rack. 8. To take your cakes out of the tins without leaving a wire rack mark on the top, put a clean tea towel over the tin, put your hand onto the tea towel, and turn the tin upside down. The cake should come out onto your hand and the tea towel. Then you can turn it from your hand onto the wire rack. 9. Set aside to cool completely. 10. To assemble the cake, place one cake upside down onto a plate and spread it with plenty of jam. If you want to, you can spread over whipped cream too. 11. Top with the second cake, top side up. Sprinkle over the caster sugar. If you don't want the trouble or don't feel comfortable making a Victoria sandwich, these cakes are very nice as just sponge cakes sprinkled with sugar or icing sugar. They make a nice accompaniment to a cup of tea. Next, we have a recipe for carrot cake. And although I've baked several carrot cakes, I haven't tried this one. So let's listen and find out how it's done.
Geraldine Holt is here. Hello again, Geraldine. Frosted carrot cake. When did we start putting vegetables in cake?
Probably quite a long time ago. Probably two or 300 years ago.
Oh, really?
Because sugar was so expensive. And if you hadn't got the kind of exotic ingredients we have today, you managed with what you had. And potatoes went in, parsnips. These days, courgettes. But carrots have survived longest.
Yes.
And they had a big revival in the Second World War when people were encouraged to put grated carrots into their Christmas puddings and their cakes.
Yeah.
But that survived. Because I think, and then I think it's probably a Swedish cake originally and then became very popular in America in the 60s.
Yeah, in my ignorance, I thought it was American, actually.
Well, no, I think it has had more of a boost in America than anywhere, and I think that's where we have now got it from.
Take us through the basic ingredients, then, Jane.
Basic ingredients are, of course, carrots, which is what you have to start with.
How much?
Only about two to three carrots, quite slim carrots.
Yeah.
It's in the recipe. And you can make it in a saucepan. And a wooden spoon. So it's incredibly simple cake to make. So you simply start by melting the butter, having grated your carrots, and then into the melted butter, you put your sugar. Lovely. This is healthy, of course. Natural.
Oh, it's natural.
Muscovado sugar.
Is it really any healthier?
I think it's healthier for the environment. It's not sugar beet.
Okay.
And then you put in your carrots. You put in your eggs, just a couple of eggs. It's actually a very economical cake because you're going to make 16, 25 pieces. If you went out and bought carrot cake, you'd only buy 3 pieces for the cost of it all.
Yes, no, that's very true.
So, and the flour.
That's self-raising flour.
Self-raising flour.
But you also use, am I right, you also use baking powder.
Yes, that's because you've got carrots. You need all this oomph from not only eggs, but self-raising flour. It's also kind of slightly gives it away as an American recipe, which this probably is because it's my mother's, who's Canadian.
Oh, I see.
And then I think the really important thing are the spices. Cinnamon.
Yep.
And grated nutmeg. And wonderful.
Can I just have it?
Coriander, which I think is nicest if you can grate it up first.
Yes, that's dried
coriander seeds.
Yes. I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised. I wouldn't have said. I know it's stupid because we make carrot and coriander soup, don't we? So
yes.
Why am I surprised that we're putting this in a cake? I don't know.
Because coriander is also a sweet spice.
Is it?
You know, in lots of mixed spices.
It doesn't overwhelm the rest of it.
No, it goes in. It does go. It's a wonderful herb. Coriander, it's a spice and a herb.
No,
walnuts.
Okay.
But
yep.
The point about the recipe is that you can change it. You needn't put raisins in. You could put sultanas. You needn't put fruit in, and you could put hazelnuts or some other nut.
Okay, what about
I think it
pecans?
Works well.
They work.
You could put pecans, but pecans are more expensive. But they are very, very nice. And if you're going to use pecans, I would put them along on the top, and so they showed when it's baked, and then I wouldn't put any frosting on. So. And in fact, the cake is really nice, not frosted as well.
So the frosting, not essential, but if you are going to do it, what's in the frosting?
So it's very simple. It's simply cream cheese. It's in the recipe, not very much, 1.5 ounces. Mix that up. It'll go quite liquid as you mix it, and then put in enough icing sugar until it's quite stiff. You can flavour it with vanilla, vanilla essence, or lemon, which is more traditional, I think, these days. So simply grated, some squeezed lemon juice and some grated shreds of lemon peel on top.
Well, I'm not very... I mean, I don't think I'm the only person not very keen on... Well, I'm not very... Yes, please, but I'm not terribly keen on cream cheese. Very, very nice.
I'm sorry, silenced you.
No, it's not a Christmas party. They should just play 45 seconds of me eating cake, which has been a feature of the programme over the last year. Lovely, Geraldine. Thank you so much for coming in. You're listening to the
Voice. Now here's a recipe for gingerbread. I did mention gingerbread briefly last month in our bread programme, but this is actually a cake. And in our house, it's an extremely popular cake, I must say. It's the cake I make most often and is also enjoyed by family as well. It's a delicious cake. For this recipe, you will need 1 pound of plain flour, 2 teaspoons ground ginger, 2 teaspoons baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon bicarbonate of soda, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 8 ounces brown sugar, 6 ounces butter or margarine, 3/4 pound of treacle or syrup, 1/2 pint of milk, 1 egg, and...
This is what you do.
1. Sieve the dry ingredients. 2. Warm the sugar, fat and treacle without overheating. 3. Warm the milk and beat the egg. 4. Combine all ingredients, mixing thoroughly. 5. Pour into a greased and lined tin. Bake in a moderate oven for 1.5 hours or until the centre is firm. 6. Turn out onto a wire rack and allow to cool. Wrap in foil and store in an airtight container. And the secret with this cake, boys and girls, is if you can store it for a few days before you actually cut it and start to eat, it will allow the syrup to settle and the cake will become beautifully moist and very, very sticky. It is absolutely delicious. And finally, a recipe for chocolate brownies. lots of different ways of making chocolate brownies, but these are particularly delicious and, as we will hear, do not contain too much sugar.
Claire Burnett of Chococo, a company from Dorset. Now, you don't like to boast, but I know that you reckon that your chocolate brownies are pretty much perfection.
Well, there are millions of different ways of making brownies.
Don't be modest.
Yeah. But mine are particularly squidgy and particularly scrumptious and don't contain too much sugar either.
Yeah, I mean, it is the element of squidge that I don't know what the chemical formula for squidge is or what it should be, but that's the key element of any decent chocolate brownie, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think the trick is to cook them for less time than you think you need to. A lot of people will overcook their brownies because the brownies, actually, when you take them out of the oven, will carry on cooking for a bit longer.
Okay, what, really?
Yep.
How much longer do they carry on cooking?
Well, as they cool, they set, because it's basically, my brownies are a blend of eggs, lots of chocolate, and a touch of, it's actually fine rice flour, but it can be normal flour, but just enough to bind it together. So it actually is basically, it's a cooked mousse, really.
And the brownie tin, you say you need a brownie tin. Well, what is it? And what if you haven't got one and can't afford one?
Well, any baking tin will do. Just this one I brought here this morning is just a square baking tin. So nothing too large, because otherwise then your brownie will spread out over the sort of the length of the tin.
All right, but you're going to start, aren't you, by melting the chocolate and the butter?
I am indeed. So I've got some unsalted butter that's going into a bowl that's sitting over a pan of gently warm water. And into that I'm going to add chopped 70% dark chocolate. And we're going to leave those two to melt together gently over the next few minutes.
Is it difficult to melt chocolate? Because that can be a little bit tricky, can't it, if you're not sure what you're doing?
It can be if you're not sure. There's sort of melting chocolate for recipes like this, and then there's tempering chocolate, which is an art in itself. But when you're melting chocolate, the trick is to treat it gently and be patient and do it slowly. Don't try and rush it.
Well, Claire, follow your own advice. Do it nice and slowly. I have to say that there are some ones she made earlier, I can't pretend I took any hand in that, and they're just about 2 or 3 feet away from me, but I'm going to have to resist temptation. We got as far as melting the chocolate.
Melting the chocolate with the butter, which I put in a bowl that was sitting over a pan of gently warm water, and it's all melted down beautifully, and I've taken it off the pan to let it cool for a few minutes, and all I'm now going to do is break 3 eggs. I've started this.
Can I know it's pedantic, but are they large, medium?
They are large, and obviously free range. Yeah. I always work with large eggs. Now, ideally, well, if you make this at home, if you want super squidgy brownies, is use an electric hand whisk. That's the most complex piece of kitchen equipment that I use, to be honest, at home.
Well, if I'm making something, I have made brownies, I always just use the metal spoon, is that?
Yeah, you can do, but it will give you, if you mix the sugar, and I always like to use light muscovado, I think it gives lovely toffee rich notes, but I use much less sugar than you'd find in other brownie recipes. So by using 70% dark chocolate, which obviously has some sugar in anyway, much less sugar, but use muscovado that's adding, light muscovado, it's adding a little bit more depth and fudginess of flavour, that will help give you much more oomph to your finished brownies.
Well,
as
I mean,
well,
some chocolate brownies, I'm not going to name names, do contain an enormous amount of sugar.
They are scary, and it overpowers. Let the chocolate sing. Buy the best quality chocolate you can, and let it sing. Let it be about the chocolate, not about the sugar.
Let's talk about, you've mentioned the muscovado sugar, the nuts. Now, I think you've got pecan nuts in this.
I've got pecans.
Recipe.
I like pecans. It's a personal preference. But if you have a brownie recipe, mine or any other, that has walnuts or any other kind of nut, just replace it with the nuts that you like. And I like, again, I think pecans have a more interesting flavour note than walnuts, although walnuts are probably more traditional. But you don't have to use nuts. So you could replace, say, for example, my recipe has 100 grams of pecans. You could replace that with an equivalent of chopped stem ginger or crystallised ginger or macadamias or cherries. Well, you know, you can basically replace.
Are you taking away from the sweetness a bit? Or is that the idea?
Yeah, it'll mix and match. It'll give you a different effect at the finish. But you can be quite brave and play with flavour with brownies, really, as, you know, and be as creative as you like.
Now, what about other toppings? Because let's say something goes terribly wrong and you end up with with a slightly dry brownie. Lob a bit of cream on top. That's the answer, isn't it?
Absolutely. Or my top tip would be pop it back in the oven to warm it, because a warm brownie is always going to be softer and squidgier, and top it with some vanilla ice cream and make a little bit of chocolate sauce. And you can make the simplest chocolate sauce by mixing chocolate with water, believe it or not, and pour that over the top and some fresh fruit, job done.
Chocolate and water will make a chocolate sauce?
Absolutely. But you have to keep adding hot water. So you're melting chocolate again in a bowl over a pan of water, and then you add hot water and you keep stirring it. To start with, it will go gungy. If you keep adding water, it will eventually thin and it will create a lovely liquidy sauce, the simplest sort of chocolate sauce you could make.
Is it possible to ever freeze these things? Is that possible?
Yes, but it'll never be as good as when you made it fresh and ate it fresh. And don't, with a brownie, don't try and leave it for weeks on end. You know, eat it the day you make it.
Or within a couple of days, really.
Yes.
Ideally.
Okay. Absolutely.
And stick them in the tin, obviously, between times. So how far have you got them with the ones you're making?
Well, first? I have just blended up some sugar, the sugar and the eggs. Ideally, as I say, if you did it with an electric hand whisk, it would make it really frothy and airy and sort of double in volume. And then I've got just 50 grams of fine rice flour, because a lot of people are intolerant to wheat these days, so my gluten-free option is fine rice flour, but you could use grated almonds and ground almonds as well, or normal flour. It's a purely personal preference. I find the fine rice makes a nice smooth brownie, but a lot of people use ground almonds if they want to do a gluten-free version.
And do you line the tin, do you?
I do, again, foil or baking parchment, whatever you've got at home. So keep it simple, and folding together the flour into the egg and sugar mix, and then adding that to my cooled butter and chocolate mix. I've also popped in a quarter of a teaspoon, just a smidgen, of crushed sea salt as well, which just also helps to bring out the chocolate flavour.
Sea salt?
Yes, yes. Well,
I would never have thought of that. Okay, and this goes in a preheated oven, which
preheated
we preheated to 180, was it?
Absolutely, and I cook in my oven, I cook it for 15 minutes. Bring it out, and the sign of a cooked brownie is that it's cooked around the edge, but still almost wobbly in the middle. So you think, whoa, that's not quite cooked. But as we said earlier, it will continue to cook and to set as it comes out and as it cools.
I would like a brownie now. So if you can bring one of those over, that would be absolutely great. Well, that is exquisite. Well worth the effort. I'm sure that rice flour makes all the difference. And there's hardly any sugar. Well, Claire, that was brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's delicious. Really moist and quite absolutely just the right amount of gooiness. Fantastic.
So there we are. That completes our baking theme for the time being. If you'd like to contact the programme with feedback, queries, any recipes you'd like to share, any cooking experiences you would like to tell us about, etc., you can do so by emailing cooking@theglobalvoice.info. That's COOKIN @theglobalvoice.info. To download or to listen to this show again, go to theglobalvoice.info/gallery, or you can visit incx.org, where you can subscribe to the What's Cooking podcast. Well, that's all we have time for today. So until I'm with you again, this is Sue Hadfield saying, take care of yourselves and each other. And as always, happy cooking.